Today I'm joined by Vinay Palmer. Vinay is a Chief Customer Experience Officer with over 30 years of experience. He's regularly seen all over the world as a keynote speaker. He's a NED at Curo Housing and has worked in senior leadership positions across customer experience, digital experience, and as a managing director. And is most recently the Chief Customer, or has most recently been the Chief Customer Officer at National Express. Vinay is now the founder of Druva Star, and they transform and redefine your customer experience so that more customers choose you, recommend you, and trust you. So it's not just a competitive edge, it's a game changer. Vinay, hi, how are you today?
Hello, I'm good, thank you, Michelle, and I hope you are well too.
Yeah, and lovely.
It's a shame it's been pouring down with rain all day, but...
It's been a terrible few days, hasn't it, with the weather? Hopefully it'll improve a little bit. And so you're ready to get into this? I'm looking forward to hearing more from you. Yeah.
Let's go for it.
Brilliant. So we recently spoke about some of the challenges you were hearing from customer directors, CX leaders, chief customer officers, etc., and really about how they are struggling to get buy-in from stakeholders for budgets. What do you see as some of the common themes and causes for this then?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So when I've been out networking, that's exactly what I hear when I speak to people. Their number one challenge is sponsorship, investment in initiatives, the exec not getting it, for want of a better phrase. And I think my observation there is, I guess it's this, there's a number of things happening. I think, you know, obviously you and I have spoken about the change in structures in organizations where, you know, customer functions that once maybe reported directly into a CEO are now being restructured and pushed into a CMO or a CCO, who aren't necessarily experts in CX and don't necessarily know what they've got. But I think the other thing as well that I observe is that if I take a step sideways first and kind of give you a bit of a preamble to what I'm about to say, when you look at anything to do with high performance and sort of personal performance, one of the key fundamentals in that is the ability to take responsibility. And that's not from the perspective of fault, as in you caused a problem, therefore you take responsibility. It's to take responsibility for your responses and the way that you are. And in that conversation, when I hear they're not getting it, and I'm not getting sponsorship, my kind of coaching question to that is, well, have you ever thought that maybe that starts with you? What are you doing differently? And that's no slight on the people that I'm talking to. They're exceptional people, really talented, no CX inside out, you know, brilliant people. But I guess it's the bit about how do you kind of take responsibility for that communication that they're not getting it. And what I mean by that is that CX has a unique role in an organization that it sits horizontally. It pretty much touches every single part of the business: sales, marketing, product development, commercial, finance, you know, you name it, it touches it. So as a CX leader, you have a unique horizontal perspective of all the various parts of your business, whereas many of your colleagues are slightly more vertical in terms of their particular discipline and what they do. And I think part of the skill and a part of the challenge is the ability to step out of your seat and step into the seats that are opposite you and speak from their perspective. So be able to kind of talk in a way that you connect with the operations director or you connect with the marketing director. And I don't mean on a personality level, I mean in terms of language, understanding the fires that they're putting out, the challenges that they're dealing with, and you're able to articulate what it is that you're trying to do or achieve in a way that is a win-win. You know, you kind of see the connecting of the dots. And if you can do that, I think you can start to create better buy-in, better co-ownership, and through resilience and perseverance, you will get the sponsorship that you're looking for. So that's kind of my observation in that space.
Yeah, it's a great point and a really, really important one, I think, for all customer experience leaders, isn't it? I think I remember one person said once, if you can't explain something really well in sort of like 15 or 20 seconds, you shouldn't be explaining it at all type of thing. And I think because CX is such a young discipline, the most C-suite, they don't get it, do they? And sort of we seem to one of the CX leaders I speak to, you know, we're great at talking about the customer and doing all of these things, but as you say, we're not speaking their language, we're not making it cut through and have that impact, are we, in those conversations?
Yeah, completely. And if you think about, you know, let's take another thing that I'm passionate about, and I know that we'll probably speak on that a little bit later on, it's about diversity and inclusion. You know, there's the conversation about allies and having people, you know, other people in the business that are allies to you, that it's not the burden and the responsibility of the individual to constantly talk about D&I. Well, in the same way or a similar way, CX is the same. It's about creating allies, and that's by developing a strong network internally, the relationships you have, the win-wins you create, as you say, by understanding those different perspectives and what people are doing. And I think the other thing is to realize that, all, you know, if you think about a P&L in a business, customer experience tends to sit in the L as opposed to the P. And that's okay. But I think sometimes the challenge is also is that when we're trying to justify or create the business case for the things we're doing, the benefits don't necessarily sit in customer experience. In fact, they probably don't sit in customer experience. The benefits are found in marketing, in operations, in commercial. Yeah. And again, working in collaboration with those teams, you should be able to co-create and create a compelling story together to say, well, if we did this over here, we're creating this change that does this, but that results in a higher conversion or greater loyalty because customers come back, or actually it's improving our brand trust score so that when the branding and the marketing are promising X, it's actually being delivered in reality, and therefore their customers are developing greater trust in our brand.
Yeah, and that point as well that you make about that customer accounting, because it's not just, as you say, the benefits are elsewhere, but it's also elsewhere that's creating the drive for the contact. It's not the customer service center that's driving it's coming from these other functions, isn't it, as well? And I think that's important. Yeah. So it's not that that function alone isn't creating the demand that's creating the loss, is it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you often hear people talking about, well, can you reduce the calls coming into the contact center or deflect the calls? Well, the contact center only exists in its first instance because stuff's going wrong elsewhere.
Yeah.
The more that you fix outside of it, you will naturally reduce the call volumes coming in, and customers will have to call less or contact less to get stuff done.
Yeah, it's great. Okay. So, I mean, we've spoken about things, you know, the vanity metrics, let's say, that drive NPS, and they can lead to the wrong behaviours. And you have some good ideas, and you've touched on it already around building trust and loyalty, advocacy. Can you just tell us a little bit more on that then?
Yeah, I think I spoke about this recently at a conference. I think I upset one or two people in the crowd that were NPS fans. And I'm not, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying NPS isn't an important measure. I think NPS absolutely is, but it's measuring the intent for somebody to recommend and the manner in which it's done as well. You know, the response rate you get, the group of people that respond to it, you know, you normally only hear from a real kind of polarized audience. It's either really, really good or it's really, really poor. So I think it's got its limitations, but it's a good indicator. The vanity metric piece comes from, actually, are there any consequences tied to an NPS when it falls? And actually, are you celebrating the joint benefits when it goes the other way? There's lots of high-fiving and backslapping and saying, great, we've got a really great NPS, but actually, what is the consequence of it falling, and really understanding what that drives? And I think, you know, it can become a target, and I don't think NPS was ever meant to be a target, it was meant to be an indicator. So you end up chasing this number and trying to drive this NPS number up without really having a coherent and a clear line to your strategy about what that represents. And I think similarly, CSAT is also got its limitations. You know, it measures it in the moment. And again, when you're sending out surveys, and, you know, we've heard lots of people talk about the days of asking customers what they think are coming to an end, and we should be able to just find it through the dialogue that they have, but it has its limitations about in that moment, it tells you what's going on. But I think what we're really after, when you think about and pull back the layers for customer experience, whichever phrase you want to use or whatever language you want to use about it, I think there are three fundamental things that we really want to get our customers or get our customers to behave in a way around it. One is we want them to feel a level of trust and behave in a way that they have a high level of trust in us. The second is that we want them to be loyal so that in that moment of decision, they're not walking across to our competitors and choosing them, but they stick with us because we've done a great job for them and there's a sense of loyalty. And the third one is the advocacy piece, the bit about them being our raving fans and telling other people about us. And those three are the things that we want to kind of really measure. So it's getting into those kind of things. And, you know, NPS kind of talks a little bit to advocacy. But then to get down further, if those are behaviors, there are emotions behind those behaviors, because all behavior is driven by emotions. And it's understanding, well, how is it that you want to measure that, how your customers feel, that increases the propensity of that behavior to occur? So, you know, how does a customer need to feel in order to have that level of trust? How does a customer need to feel in order to be an advocate? How do they need to feel in order to be loyal? So measuring those kind of emotive things behind those behaviors, I think, is an important thing to get to. I was talking to a brand, I won't say who they are, but they're a brand that provide a service, and they do a great job for their customers. But they are a pest control service. Now, when they ask their customers, will you recommend us? Their customers say no, because they don't want people to know that they have used a pest service in their restaurant. In fact, when they arrive, they ask them to park around the back and make sure that nobody sees them, right? Because the last thing you want to see is his van in front of your... But what they do, what they are interested in is, what they do hear, sorry, from the customers is their customers trust them to do a great job. So actually the measure for them might be more appropriately to measure trust as far as their customer base is gone, because that's most important to them. And they know that if they have high trust, then that's a good thing with their customers, as opposed to, oh my God, people aren't recommending this, that's a really bad thing. But there's a context and a reason for that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, again, another great point. And I remember it was a few years ago now, and that Fred Riekeld spoke at the Customer Experience Awards. Yeah, you know, obviously the Bain consultant and the NPS, what's the word? He created the NPS, didn't he? But he, I'm not going to say the words that he said, because I'll misquote him, but he was something like, it was never meant as a stick to beat people with. And that's ultimately what it is in so many organisations, isn't it? I think anyone that's really interested in NPS should really look at the foundations of why it was created before they sort of relook at how they use it in the work in the working sense.
I was at a presentation with a Dutch bank, and they were moving away from NPS, and what they've decided to measure instead is satisfaction, trust, and love in their metrics. And what they're able to show on this graph was that even though satisfaction might fluctuate a little bit here and there, when they measured trust and love with their customers, that stayed pretty consistent, and they were able to tie back to say that actually customers that display high love and high trust, I think, were something like 2.5 times more likely to buy another product, and twice as less likely to churn than those that displayed lower levels of trust and love. And so you've got organizations experimenting with it. So I guess the real point is, don't be blinded by CSAT and NPS. Think about what it is you're trying to drive in your organization, and measure the things that are important to you in terms of CSAT. The other thing is also to have that broader view to go, well, there are customer experience indicators, but of course in organizations, we have a bunch of other KPIs. And as you know, what gets measured gets done, you know, KPIs drive behavior. And often what we're not alive to is those unintended consequences and unintended competing KPIs that, when they're set in silo, make absolute sense. But when you look at them in the round, they create competing behaviors against teams, and then they force people to behave in a certain way to achieve that target, which then creates a knock-on negative effect for another area of the business. So in its standalone, it looks great because you've hit the KPI, but actually what it's driving is a counterproductive behavior.
Yeah, it's so important. Very, really good points. Thank you. So you came to the role of a chief customer officer again, you know, a new role really in the grand scheme of things, and a lot of companies trying it out or on for size. And before that, you were a managing director and a customer experience and digital director, and with a background of change and contact centers. So how do you think, or how did you find the role, and what do you think business and leaders need to do to ensure that the role of the CCO survives and I guess thrives in the UK?
Yeah, great question. How did I find the role? I really enjoyed it, but it was really hard. I was a one-man evangelist in the organisation, and a lot of my time was spent influencing my peers to reallocate spending in their already tight budgets, or to think about investing in initiatives that they hadn't planned in. So I think it just really tests your resolve, your resilience, your ability to build relationships, articulate benefits, find win-wins, be creative. You know, some of the things that I started to kind of do was to try to, so for example, trying to roll out a particular training program or a rollout of a new set of standards rather than create a new campaign and trying to get people to buy into, look, we need to invest in this and do it that way, was to look for vehicles that already exist and piggyback those and be more creative. So you're not creating another cost, but you're building onto something that's already there. So I think it really does help you to become creative and think differently and approach things differently. But you do have to have a thick skin. You do have to be resilient, and you have to understand that changing behavior and changing people's beliefs takes time. It takes evidence. You know, we don't change them overnight. You know, we all know, for example, that we need to eat a healthy diet and, you know, exercise more. So we all know that intuitively, in the same way as that every exec knows that treating customers well will lead to loyalty and advocacy. But knowing it and doing it are two different things, right? And unfortunately, as I've come to know, human beings in terms of change, you know, people don't tend to change until the pain of staying the same is greater than the pain of changing. So something has to happen. So either that's a regulator coming in over the top and going, right, we're going to put some regulation in to make you do it. Either there's a big disaster around reputation or something that causes you to do that, or something else fundamental that happens in the organization that creates the leverage to do that. It takes time. It's, you know, it's almost like being a sculptor and chipping away and revealing what's underneath, as opposed to being able to create something, you know, super quick and make it happen. So it's for the long haul. And I think the conditions really are is that I would encourage anyone who's looking at that role to try and keep it in the C-suite, to keep that voice at the table, because the moment it disappears from there, the conversation changes. So if you can keep it at that C-suite level, have the voice of the customer in the room, keep playing back what you're hearing, what you're finding, the insights in a really powerful way, it keeps the team honest, it keeps them focused on the customer, and it allows you to keep building your case for the initiatives and things that you want to do.
Thank you. Great advice and thoughts. And I'd ask you, I spoke to somebody else who'd been in customer experience for a long time, and they said about the CCO role, they said they thought, their opinion, and you tell me what you think, that people either went in and pushed too hard and bounced out the company, or the company removed the role very quickly, or they had to take a real step back and, I suppose, to that point of resilience, become much more patient and accept that they weren't going to make the change they wanted in such a quick period of time. But so they wouldn't achieve as much as quickly, but it would work over that time. I mean, you've said some of that. Do you sort of agree with that, or have any thoughts to that?
Yeah, I partly agree with that. I think you can jump at it too hard and try and change things too quickly, and of course it all depends on the context of the organization that you're in, you know, the different cultures, different leadership and all of those things. But that notwithstanding, I think patience is key, and I think actually, you know, the emergence of things like Agile and Test and Learn, they're tools that you can really leverage and benefit from. So rather than trying to go a big bang and build something that hits everything at the same time, trying to use that methodology of finding something, testing and learning, proving the value, and then rolling it out is a great way for you to kind of, you know, drive your discipline. If, you know, I was lucky that I was looking after digital and customer, so I was able to use both of those methodologies, you know, the agile way of working, and then overlaying that with some of the initiatives we wanted to do, just, you know, testing things out in isolation and then coming back and saying, well, this has worked, we've seen this benefit, let's see if we can roll it out across the whole piece. So I think that, you know, those kind of things are all things that you should be grasping at right now, and looking to see how can I use those to my advantage.
Yeah, great. Okay. So as you touched on earlier, we talk a lot about diversity, and like me, you were raised and educated in and around Birmingham. So what advice would you give to business leaders when it comes to inspiring more diverse, aspirational leaders?
Oh, really great question. So you will have seen me say a number of times that diversity without inclusion is a waste of time. So I think for leaders, it's about creating the culture of inclusion, that people feel like they're included. And that's either through invitation and sometimes dragging people into the conversation. And sometimes you can leave an invitation and people will come run into the conversation. But I think first and foremost, it's about creating an inclusive culture where people feel that they can be, that they're part of it. They're in the circle. They're not ostracized and pushed out because of their background, because of any particular, characteristics or those kind of things. So I think that's point number one. I think point number two is that you look around you at who you've got in those kind of junior roles and organizations and start to look at how you can help elevate them and again, I guess, give them a step up. And what I mean by that is that sometimes, and this might sound odd to you, but I'm from an Indian culture. And in my culture, historically, it's quite a subservient culture. So, you do as you're told, you don't question your elders. And sometimes you're kind of conditioned to only step in when you're invited. So you're dealing with people that might want to do things, but might not feel that they can. They're waiting to be asked and invited in. So I think that's an awareness piece in there as well. So I think those two things are really, really important. And don't underestimate the power of when people look up and see somebody like them, it makes all the difference. I never really understood the power of position in an organization. So I never really saw myself as particularly senior. A title is just a title. I really don't buy into that whole kind of piece. And I didn't realize that me being in the position that I was in an organization, I didn't realize how much it meant to people that were in lower positions. And when they looked up, when they saw me, it made a real difference to them. I had no awareness of it until I started to talk to people when I was involved in the D&I Council. We were chatting about other things, but people would say that. And it really surprised me, but also puts that extra pressure on my shoulders that I'm kind of carrying that kind of torch for them. And it's kind of like, go back to my shoulder, the first time I saw Madhu Jaffrey on the BBC TV doing a cookery show, and all of a sudden there was a lady that looked like my mom on the TV cooking, and it made all the difference in the world. So I think people, the symbolism of seeing people like you around the place, the symbolism of people you seeing being progressed and promoted, and not necessarily put into positions because of positive discrimination or anything like that. I think just given the opportunity to show up and be in that and be in that space, I think that has real power.
Yeah, it's such a good point, and you hear it more and more often. And I know there's another CEO from Many Pets, Oki Ilezu, and he speaks about it all of the time. You need to see it to believe it, and it's such an important, powerful point, I think.
Yeah.
And so really, really well made. And so for diverse and aspirational leaders, if they are thinking, it's not possible, it's a closed door, how will I ever get there? I mean, what sort of advice and thoughts would you give to them?
I think there's a real honest conversation to have and an assessment about is it just a tick box exercise, and does the culture really do that? And I think being brave enough to have that conversation is really key. And I think it would be, it depends on how brave you are, but I wouldn't shy away from speaking to my CEO or somebody and just kind of talking about, look, the fact that there aren't any other people that look like me around the board table, what are we doing about that, how are we doing that, and challenging that conversation. And you quickly will be able to tell whether it's just lip service and somebody saying all the right things, or if there's a genuine desire to want to change things. I think some of, there are other indicators as well that tell you the kind of thing. If you find that because of you're that particular protected characteristic, so if you're a woman, you're transgender, if you're a person of color, whatever, but you're the person in the room who ends up being the one that continually calls out whether something's sexist, whether something's ageist, whether something's racist, or they haven't taken that into account, or that we haven't thought about somebody with a disability or any of those other characteristics, if that's what's continually happening and other people aren't calling it out, well then you've got to ask yourself a question about whether that's the right place for you. Now that's quite a strong statement to make, and it's easier said than done to leave a role, but it tells you, it's an indicator for you to tell you what it's really like there. So I think it's about being brave.
Yeah, but the reality is that, I mean, if you look at the entry level in organisations, we've probably got really good diversity there, but we lose it as they come up the ranks. So they're losing the people anyway, aren't they, ultimately? So as you say, if they can ask those questions, people are walking away, and that's what we've got to stop, I think, as business leaders. We've really got to encourage this talent to stay and to build our future. And that's, you know, it's good advice because it's a two-way thing, isn't it? And hopefully there are leaders who will sit up if people are calling them on it, and can be brave enough to do that.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it comes back to, you know, was it Tony Blair famously went education, education, education. It comes back to education, right? It comes back to a willingness to have that conversation and delve into those uncomfortable places that you don't know, that, you know, and I can imagine that on the other side of the table, there are people worried about saying something because they might sound racist or they might sound sexist, or it could be a career ending comment they've made innocently, but they don't realize they've said the wrong thing. But it's creating that psychological safety and that space that you can have those kind of things. And look, one of the things I will absolutely say is that the last 2 years, or I guess the years preceding the George Floyd incident and the Black Lives Matter movement, the years that came after that, where we started, people really started to take more notice of diversity and inclusion and things that had happened in organisations. I've had conversations in my workplace that I never thought I'd ever have. Like, you know, real, real hard conversations about, you know, helping people to peel back the layer and say, did you not notice that? Did you not see that? You know, this is how it made me feel. And those kind of things, so that I think, you know, those conversations do happen, but, like, you know, go back to the CX piece, there's patience, there's resilience, but I think there's openness to have and a willingness to have that dialogue.
Great. Well, thank you. And, you know, coming from Birmingham like yourself, you know, and when I speak to female leaders as well, I can't believe we're still having this conversation, frankly. You know, I just don't get it. But here we are. And we'll keep banging the drum, won't we? So thanks for your thoughts on that. So is there anything else that you'd like to add, Vinay?
No, I think, look, you know, CX, as you say, it's still a fairly young discipline. I guess the thing to really think about it is to not think of it as a thing that's separate from the organization. CX is the DNA of the organization. It flows through everything you do. And I think I posted the other day, it's also the other way to think about it. It's not a one and done. You don't do it. You don't deploy CX and then that's it. It's a product. You are continuously evolving it, responding to what customers are doing. You have to have a continuous improvement program. But it should be something that people are afraid of and think it's that team over there that does it. It's a collective responsibility. It touches every part of the organization. And the more that people are interested in it, the more they'll be able to kind of go, oh, yeah, I get that. And I understand how I influence that. And I understand the contribution that I can make in helping to fix those kind of things. You know, going back to the measures piece that we talked about, and just kind of, I guess, finish on this really is that, you know, we pay attention. It's like at school, isn't it? The kid at the top of the class gets all the attention. The kid at the bottom of the class gets all the attention. But then you have a bunch of people in the middle that are just kind of left to their own devices. And I think in customer experience is a similar thing. Those promoters and people that will rave about you get lots of attention because we're really happy that we've got those. We pay attention to the complaints and the people that will have a really poor experience. But those in the middle that are kind of have a meh experience, but will probably quickly move to a competitor the moment they get a chance. That's where our focus is. And if we can reduce the number of people that feel that way and are more likely to stay with us, that's the kind of silent killer in an organization. When you don't know it's happening, people are just voting with their feet. They're not complaining. They're not telling you. They're just moving on to somebody else. And that can be somebody on their very first interaction with you. You know, you might have tried really hard to acquire new customers coming in. And that first interaction will be make or break and they'll never use you again. Or it could be somebody that's really had you for a long time and then you've let them down really badly in a situation. They've just gone, oh, I'm just going to go elsewhere and do it. So it's the awareness of that middle ground, I think, is really, really important.
Another great point. Thank you. And I didn't put this on the questions because you hadn't come up with the name of your brand before when we set this up. But why Drew the Star? Tell us a little bit about that.
So yeah, really interesting. So one of the key pieces and fundamentals in my work is about helping organizations find their North Star around customer experience. And my belief and my experience tells me that often the problem that really occurs is when there isn't a clarity of vision at the top that aligns with the strategic objective or is not part of the strategic objective, or there's not a clarity for people to look at and go, I understand what we're trying to do there. So the North Star is the first fundamental piece. Once you get that bit right and people understand what it is that you're trying to do and why you're trying to do it, everything else underneath it becomes easier to put into place. So, you know, I searched Polestar, already gone because there's a famous car maker that made that one, North Star and all of these different things. And I found myself looking at different mythology and just linking back to the, you know, an interesting, but linking back to the diversity point. I don't know why I didn't first just default back to my own culture and ancestry. So then I looked up the Sanskrit word for what is North Star, and that's where Dhruva Star came from. And Dhruva is a story of a young boy, Dhruv, who through dedication, through unwavering faith, wanted to connect with the gods and was transformed into the North Star. And so that's where it came from. Dhruva Star is the Sanskrit translation of North Star. So what it represented for me was the work I do, North Star, but also my heritage and my ancestry. So it brings the two together. So that's where the name came from.
What a great story. Brilliant. I'm glad I asked. Thank you for sharing. And a great brand, all linked together. Really good. So, yeah, and just before we go, I did say I would mind, if you wouldn't mind, you know, you know myself and Douglas Jackson, you've known me for some time. Do you have any thoughts? I mean, how do you find us?
I think that the stuff that you produce is really, really helpful. In fact, I got an email just before our call talking about the appointments you've had. It helps you keep ahead of the trends and stuff that are in there. Any engagements that you and I have had have always been really positive. So I've always enjoyed working with Douglas Jackson.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much. Super, Vinay, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and sort of experience. I'm sure it will sort of go down really well with everybody else, as it has with myself today. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Cheers.